We would like to send out a special thanks to Best Fiends for supporting The Trail Went Cold. Best Fiends is a unique and exciting puzzle experience unlike other puzzle games out there. Best Fiends updates the game monthly with new levels and events, so it never gets old. You can download it free on the Apple App Store or Google Play. Thank you, and enjoy the show. November 8th, 1985. Harris County, Texas. The charred body of 52-year-old Ed Baker, the millionaire chairman of an oil investment business, is discovered inside his burned-out car in a remote field. Since Baker was suffering from serious financial problems and claimed he was receiving death threats, there is suspicion that he was murdered by people he owed money to. However, others suspect that Baker staged an elaborate suicide in order to ensure that his family could collect on his life insurance policies. It is also theorized that Baker may have faked his own death and fled the country, but the actual circumstances of what happened to him remain unknown. After that, the trail went cold. Hello everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host Robin Warder, and today we're going to be exploring a bizarre case which was featured on Unsolved Mysteries, the 1985 death of Ed Baker. Or did he actually die? This is a pretty unique story about a man who built up a multi-million dollar oil investment business before it all came crashing down and he wound up dead. The charred remains of Baker's body would be discovered inside his burnt-out car in a remote field, and on the surface, this seemed like a clear-cut case of foul play, since Baker had been experiencing severe financial problems and displaying paranoid behavior prior to his death, which suggested that his life was in danger. But it turned out that opinions about this case would be sharply divided, as there was other evidence to suggest that Baker could have staged an elaborate suicide and made it look like a murder, so that his family could collect his life insurance benefits. And there was also a third possibility. Even though investigators were pretty certain that the victim inside the vehicle was Baker, his body was burned so badly that some people suspected that he could have faked his own death in order to escape his troubles. So could the victim have actually been an unidentified John Doe? Even if Baker really did die that day, was it suicide, or was someone else responsible for his death? Well, after nearly 35 years, there are still no conclusive answers about what actually happened, but the possibilities are endless, so we're going to be exploring a number of different theories about this case on today's episode. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now delve into the unexplained death of Ed Baker. Our story begins in Texas in 1985. Our central figure is 52-year-old Edward Gerald Baker, who goes by the name Ed and currently lives in Houston. Ed spent the early part of his life working such jobs as a shoe salesman and an insurance agent, and had two daughters and a son with his first wife. But after 20 years of marriage, tragedy would strike on Thanksgiving weekend in 1973, when Ed's wife was killed in a car wreck. He would soon get remarried to a woman named Mary Ella, and eventually decided to start his own company called Vanguard Groups International. At the outset, Ed only had 3 employees working under him, including Mary, and the company initially specialized in such ventures as building inexpensive housing and selling partnerships in commercial real estate development. However, by the time the 1980s rolled around, the oil industry was hitting a major boom period in Texas, so Baker decided to start using Vanguard to sell limited partnerships in speculative oil wells. After achieving some early success with promoting oil well exploration, it wasn't long before Baker developed a reputation for being a brilliant strategist who was able to develop clever tax shelter programs and sell them to wealthy investors who were happy to trust him with their money. As a result, Vanguard would be featured in Inc. magazine for 3 consecutive years on their annual Inc. 500 list of the fastest-growing privately held companies in the United States. By 1984, the company was housed in a newly constructed office building, and its sales had reached $19 million. However, as Ed's wealth grew, it seemed like he wanted to change his lifestyle, and in March of that year, he decided to divorce Mary after 10 years of marriage. In September, Ed married his 3rd wife, Karen Walbridge, but the marriage would prove to be short-lived, and Ed would file for divorce from her only 5 months later. Only 4 days after this divorce was finalized, Ed got married for the 4th time to Sandy Hoff, one of his employees at Vanguard. It was also around this time period when Ed began to spend money excessively and became heavily involved in high-stakes gambling. However, this would eventually come back to bite him, because without his investors' knowledge, Baker had been borrowing their money to support and maintain his lavish lifestyle. He likely assumed that he would be able to repay that money once he attracted another round of investors, but as 1985 rolled around, the price of crude oil started dropping in a huge way. This would lead to an oil glut which drastically worsened over the next 2 years and had a major negative impact on Houston's economy. As a result, Vanguard started experiencing serious financial hardship as Baker found himself unable to attract many people to invest in his oil well deals. As the year went on, Vanguard's investors, most of whom had invested a minimum of $200,000 each, were clamoring for money, but Baker was unable to repay them. 3 lawsuits were filed against Vanguard, including one from Wingo Energy, who complained about having invested in an oil drilling operation which was never completed. By October, Vanguard was on the verge of bankruptcy, and Baker's issues with his investors, as well as some tax problems, meant that he was not only in danger of losing his company, but he could also be facing potential jail time. Baker told his private investigator, Bob Gale, that in order to escape financial ruin, he was arranging a bailout with 2 men from Miami who were going to loan him $1 million. According to Gale, Baker was concerned because he had heard that these men might have some sort of connection to the mafia and organized crime, so he wanted Gale to run a background check on them. Well, at around 7:30 p.m. on the evening of November the 6th, Ed suddenly decided to show up at the home of his ex-wife Mary, and he appeared to be very paranoid and anxious. Mary said that she had never seen Ed look this frightened before, as he started rambling on about how he was being followed, and that over the past 2 weeks, he had received some letters at work containing death threats. Ed also told Mary that earlier that day, he had received 2 threatening phone calls at his home number, even though it was unlisted, and the caller said, quote, "Today is your day to die." Before he left Mary's house, Ed mentioned that he had sent his current wife Sandy to her daughter's home in Austin for her own protection. Hours later, at approximately 1 a.m. on the morning of November the 7th, Sandy said that she spoke to Ed over the phone from Austin, and he told her that he was holed up in his bedroom because he had just received another threatening phone call. He said there was a good possibility he might die and asked Sandy to remain strong before he ended the call. Later that morning at 9:15 a.m., Ed's gardener showed up at his residence and discovered that the house had a broken window and appeared to have been burglarized. When the gardener went inside and entered Ed's bedroom, he noticed that the telephone had been knocked off a table and an ashtray was overturned on the floor, though the rest of the house did not appear to be ransacked. There was no sign of Ed anywhere, and while a shotgun he owned appeared to be missing, most of Ed's personal items, including his jacket and a wallet containing credit cards and $900 in cash, had been left behind. Ed remained a missing person for the next 24 hours, but shortly after 9 a.m. on the morning of November the 8th, the Harris County Sheriff's Department was contacted by some farmers who reported finding a burned-out vehicle in a remote rice field located next to a dirt road about 20 miles outside of Houston. When the Sheriff's Department arrived at the scene, they discovered that the burned-out vehicle was a Jaguar sedan, and the charred remains of a person were in the passenger seat. The body was burned so badly that they could not even tell if the victim was a man or a woman, and its weight had been reduced to 32 pounds. But a check of the Jaguar revealed that it was registered to Ed Baker. Due to the condition of the remains, the authorities could not say with absolute 100% certainty that the victim was Baker. However, the medical examiner's report noted that there were at least 60 points of similarity between Ed's dental records and what was left of the victim's teeth and jaw, so the official consensus was that it was him. In addition, a ring was found with the victim, and Sandy would positively identify it as a ring she had given to her husband. A burnt .32 caliber revolver was on the vehicle's passenger side floorboard beneath the victim's feet, and there did appear to be a gunshot wound in his head. The cartridge under the revolver's firing pin had an indentation which seemed to indicate that it had been fired, while the other five shells inside the gun looked like they had exploded from the severe heat of the fire. There also appeared to be remains of a shotgun inside the vehicle, which may have been the missing shotgun from Ed's residence. A total of 3 empty 1-gallon gas cans were found inside and around the vehicle, so it seemed pretty obvious that someone had intentionally set the Jaguar on fire, and this was a case of arson. Witnesses reported having seen smoke in the rice field early on the morning of November the 7th, which meant that Ed's death likely took place only hours after his final phone call with Sandy. Around that same time period, an eyewitness had been driving through the area and noticed a blue Chevy pickup truck with chrome rails and mag wheels rapidly speeding away from the field, but the truck was never found, and it was unclear if it had any connection to what happened. In a bizarre turn of events, hours after the discovery of the burnt-out Jaguar, the body of a young man dressed in nothing more than a camouflage shirt, who appeared to be in his early 20s, was found about a quarter of a mile away from the scene. The victim had been handcuffed and killed by several blows to the head, which crushed his skull. Initially, there was speculation that this man might have been hired to kill Baker before someone else killed him, but the investigation later determined that he was murdered in a dope deal which was completely unrelated to the Baker case. As far as I can tell, this young man's name has never been released publicly, and there are virtually no details available about what happened to him, but he was likely killed around 24 hours after the first eyewitness sightings of the smoke from the burning Jaguar, so it's nothing more than an odd coincidence that these two events happened to take place in the same area. Shortly after the discovery of Baker's body, his attorney, Ward Boosey, received a letter from him which read, quote, "Mr. Ward Boosey, there have been threats on my life in the past month that I don't know how real they are. Just in case, I have written Sandy a letter that I want you to keep to give to her in case something should happen to me. I hope this isn't silly, but in these days and times, crazy things happen every day. Maybe I'm just reacting, but I've never had a threat before and it just kind of gets to me. I guess you have had experience with clients before, so you understand. If anything should happen, please help Sandy and my kids all you can. You have always been a good friend, and I know I can count on you. Thanks, Ed Baker." End quote. Indeed, Ed did enclose a second letter, which he asked Boosie to give to Sandy, though the contents of the second letter have never been revealed publicly. Following her husband's death, Sandy immediately started expressing her belief that her husband had been murdered. She suspected that he was a victim of a mafia hit because he owed a $250,000 loan to some organized crime figures. Sandy claimed that 6 weeks before Ed was killed, she accompanied him on a trip to Miami, and while he never told her specific details about what was going on, Sandy suspected that the reason Ed went down there was to meet with these organized crime figures and try to arrange another way to pay off the loan since he had already spent all the money. It would also turn out that Ed owed over $50,000 in gambling debts to at least 2 casinos in Las Vegas. Investigators would soon discover that in the days prior to his death, Ed called his life insurance agents. He inquired about whether any of the policies he had taken out would still be paid to his family in the event of a suicide, and was told that at least one policy, valued at $500,000, would not. 2 days after Ed's body was found, his 23-year-old son, Blake Edward Baker, would be arrested and charged with making a terrorist threat after he allegedly phoned up Sandy and threatened to kill her if she did not pay him the $200,000 he felt he was entitled to from his father's estate. In spite of this, Blake passed a polygraph when questioned about his father's death and was not considered to be a suspect. On November the 6th, shortly before he went missing, Ed officially revised his will, removing Vanguard Groups International from his life insurance policies and making his family the beneficiaries. According to his updated will, Sandy would receive $500,000 and her daughter $50,000, while Ed's two daughters received $225,000 each and Blake $150,000. His ex-wife Mary would receive $500,000 from an insurance policy she had as collateral on a 10-year alimony agreement, but one of the insurance carriers would refuse to pay out any death benefits since it could not be conclusively proven that Ed's death was not a suicide. Indeed, the fact that Ed had inquired about whether his policies would pay out convinced some of the investigators, as well as Ward Boosie, that Ed could have taken his own life. This theory was bolstered by the fact that a gun had been found on the floorboard beneath Ed's feet, leading to speculation that he shot himself. While investigators found it unlikely that Ed would have been able to pour gasoline over his body and set himself on fire before pulling the trigger, they could not discount the possibility of Ed bringing an accomplice to the scene who poured gasoline in and around the vehicle and started the fire after Ed shot himself in order to make his death look like a homicide. Ward Boosie believed that when Ed revised his will and sent him the letter about taking care of his family, he already knew he was planning to kill himself in order to escape his financial and legal problems and intentionally sent Sandy out of town before he went through with it to give his wife plausible deniability. Sandy refused to accept the idea that Ed took his own life and hired her own independent private investigator who concluded that his death was not a suicide. Shortly after Ed was killed, Sandy agreed to take a polygraph test, and the results seemed to indicate that she was withholding information. 1 month later, she agreed to take a second polygraph, but I was unable to find out how these results turned out, and Sandy eventually moved to Europe. Well, even though the burned body found in the Jaguar was officially identified as Ed Baker, some people, including Ed's private investigator, Bob Gale, had an additional theory about what might have happened to him. They wondered if perhaps the remains did not actually belong to Baker, and considered the possibility that he may have killed an unidentified victim before placing their body in his Jaguar and setting fire to it in order to fake his own death. He then escaped his troubles by fleeing the country and living off the money he had embezzled from his investors. Indeed, when Vanguard Groups International filed for bankruptcy following Baker's death, at least $10 million was unaccounted for. Whatever happened, the investigation soon hit a standstill, and even though the story was featured on an episode of Unsolved Mysteries in October of 1992, it failed to bring the case any closer to a resolution. So after nearly 35 years, the exact circumstances behind the death of Ed Baker are still unclear. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. But before we continue, we would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Best Fiends. One of the things I love most about true crime is that the further you dig into a story, the more layers you uncover. In fact, we sometimes cover cold cases containing so many layers that we feel like we're trying to put together a massive jigsaw puzzle. Well, the puzzle game Best Fiends often feels the exact same way, and that's one of the things I love about it. Reaching each new level feels like uncovering a new layer in a story which you get to take part in. And the best part is that the longer you play Best Fiends, the more fun and exciting it gets. Best Fiends updates the game monthly with new levels and events, so it never gets old, and you get to collect tons of cute characters and always face new monthly theme challenges. Over the past year, the game has gotten more challenging, but it has also gotten more fun, and it gives you a great opportunity to fine-tune your strategy. As a result, I've recently passed the milestone of level 700. One of Vest Fiends' strongest elements is that it is an accessible game for everyone, whether you're someone who just decides to play casually or you're more competitive. Vest Fiends has thousands of levels already, with new levels, events, and characters added every month. It's hours of fun right at your fingertips, and you can even play offline. With over 100 million downloads and tons of 5-star reviews, Vest Fiends is a must-play. So download Vest Fiends free on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R. Vest Fiends. Thank you, and enjoy the rest of the episode. Anyway, this is a pretty unique case, as you're not going to find too many mysteries about unexplained deaths in which the three possible solutions are homicide, suicide, or faking their own death. Usually, when a deceased person is found inside the remnants of a torched-out vehicle, and they've been burned so badly that the remains only weigh 32 pounds, you're not going to assume that a suicide took place, but in this case, you can't completely discount that possibility. While the idea of Ed Baker faking his own death and disappearing to start a new life might seem unlikely, this is not the first case I've covered on this podcast in which someone has attempted to do this. You might be familiar with my episode about Clarence Roberts, which was also featured on Unsolved Mysteries, and you can see some parallels between Clarence and Ed Baker. Clarence had also got himself into serious financial trouble before his body was found inside a burning barn on his property in what appeared to be a suicide. But it soon became obvious that the burned body found in the rubble did not belong to Clarence, and that he likely killed an unidentified vagrant in order to fake his own death. Clarence's apparent plan was for his wife Geneva to collect on his life insurance policies, and they would go off to live somewhere on the money. But since the insurance companies did not believe Clarence was dead, they refused to pay out, so Clarence was presumably forced to spend an entire decade in hiding before he died for real in another fire. We're going to talk more about this later on, but some suspected that Ed Baker was attempting a similar scheme with his own wife, Sandy. Earlier this year, our podcast also released an episode about a man named Azad Abulhosn, who was seemingly killed in a garage fire in Florida. After Azad's sister collected on one of his life insurance policies, the authorities became suspicious and determined that the burned body found inside the garage did not actually belong to him. The evidence suggested that Azad had fled to his native Lebanon in order to live off the insurance money his sister had secured for him, but in this case, he actually seemed to get away with it, since Azad has not been found to this day. Now, I'll state right up front that I do not believe Ed Baker faked his own death. They were able to make a pretty close match between Baker's dental records and what was left of the burned victim's teeth and jawbone, but the only reason they could not say with absolute 100% certainty that it was him was because this took place during the time period when DNA profiling was first starting to become a thing. Interestingly enough, Unsolved Mysteries would later produce another segment about a man named John Rubus, who was the leader of a multi-million-dollar drug network in Puerto Rico. Much like the Baker case, Rubus's charred remains were found inside a burnt-out car in a remote field, and all they could use for identification was some loose teeth and a fragment of a jawbone. However, there were a number of witnesses who had supposedly seen or talked to Rubus after he was killed, and given his immense wealth and power, this led to speculation that he faked his own death and the remains in the vehicle belonged to someone else. However, DNA testing was eventually performed on the jaw fragment, and it proved beyond a shadow of a doubt that the victim was Rubus. And I'd wager that if Ed Baker's remains were exhumed today and DNA tested, the exact same thing would happen, though I'm not sure this will ever be done, since I don't know if anyone is still actively working on this case. But I definitely think we can rule out the entire fake death theory, and the rest of this episode will focus on the debate between Baker's death being a homicide or a suicide. Now, this is not one of those stories where I'm going to pretend that the victim was a saint, as Ed Baker did commit a number of financial indiscretions prior to his death. It sounds like Ed was a decent, law-abiding man for the first part of his life, who succumbed to greed once he finally attained wealth. And it seems like his success caused him to experience some sort of weird midlife crisis as he divorced his second wife and went through two more marriages during the last year and a half of his life and went overboard with his gambling and spending habits. Incidentally, I've always loved Robert Stack's description of this during the Unsolved Mysteries segment, as he says, quote, "He began to indulge in high-stakes gambling. Baker also underwent two facelifts, took disco lessons, and purchased a flashy new Jaguar," end quote. I don't know about you, but the random mention of disco lessons always cracks me up, particularly since this was the mid-1980s, when disco's popularity was in sharp decline. Let this be a cautionary tale. Stealing money to pay for disco lessons will lead to financial ruin. But in all seriousness, even if Ed was operating his business honestly for the first few years, it sounds like things reached the point where he was operating a Ponzi scheme. He was spending his investors' money on himself to maintain his lifestyle, assuming that all the money he received from new investors would make up for that. But when the oil boom came to an end, and Baker could no longer acquire new investors, the house of cards started to fall. Unsolved Mysteries actually featured a number of fraud segments about white-collar criminals who became wanted fugitives for doing this exact thing, but the key difference is that Baker wound up dead. One of the strangest details of Ed's apparent midlife crisis was his short-lived third marriage to Karen Walbridge, which only lasted 5 months before he got remarried to Sandy. The only reason I even know anything about Karen Walbridge is because of a 2015 book written by Patricia Goldstone titled Interlock, Art Conspiracy and the Shadow Worlds of Mark Lombardi. Mark Lombardi specialized in what was described as quote-unquote conspiracy art, as he created conceptual artwork which featured drawings of alleged and financial political frauds before he was found hanging in his apartment in 2000 in an apparent suicide. The main reason Ed Baker gets a few brief mentions in this book is because Karen Walbridge was lifelong friends with Mark Lombardi, and they were apparently romantically involved at some point. At the time Karen got married to Ed, she was nearly 20 years younger than him, and it was pretty much no big secret that she only hooked up with Ed for his money. According to Karen, Ed had her followed by detectives because he thought she was having an affair, and after he got remarried to Sandy, he was supposed to pay Karen for an annulment of their marriage, but this never happened. Karen is one of the people who believes that Ed might have faked his death and fled the country, but while this book doesn't delve very deeply into this case, it does imply that a lot of the money provided to Ed, which allowed his company to have such a successful expansion, was provided by mob financiers and real estate investors who were involved in a CIA network which was operating in Texas during that time period. However, even though I have no problem believing that Baker got in way over his head and may have found himself in serious debt with some shady figures near the end of his life, I'm going to stop short on believing that his death was a massive conspiracy involving the CIA. I know that almost immediately after Ed died, his wife Sandy publicly stated that she believed her husband was killed because of his failure to pay back a $250,000 loan to some organized crime figures in Miami. And Ed's private investigator, Bob Gale, also confirmed that Ed had asked him to look into the backgrounds of two men from Miami who were going to loan him money to see if they had mafia connections. But it's never been released publicly who these men were, and it's unclear if Gale found anything in their backgrounds to suggest they had connections to organized crime. However, I do think it's interesting that Gale was one of the people who pushed forward the theory that Ed faked his own death, which makes me wonder if he found something which made him believe the story about the loan did not check out. Given how much money he owed his investors, I can definitely believe that Ed would have been desperate enough to borrow money from anybody he could in order to save his company. But it's also interesting how he owed $50,000 to a pair of casinos at the time of his death. So when Sandy said that Ed had already spent the money which had been loaned to him from these men in Miami, That could be another way of saying he gambled it all away. I guess the biggest problem with the idea that Ed was murdered by the mafia for failure to repay his debts is that if he was dead, they would never get that money back. While no one has ever openly stated this, you do get the impression that some people might have suspected that Sandy was personally involved in her husband's murder, or at the very least, knew more than she was letting on. Yes, Sandy was established as being out of town in Austin at the time Ed was killed, but she still could have conceivably hired a hitman to get rid of him. And then after finding out what happened, she then starts spouting off a story about a $250,000 loan to the mafia in order to take suspicion off herself. Sandy did take a polygraph test, which seemed to indicate that she was withholding information, and she also collected a larger chunk of money from Ed's life insurance policies than anyone else in his life, even his own biological children. It's also interesting that almost immediately following Ed's death, his son Blake wound up being arrested for threatening to kill Sandy until he received his share of his father's estate. Unfortunately, I was unable to find out what ultimately happened with Blake's legal situation, or if he wound up doing any prison time for this, but his actions suggest that there was some major hostility between him and Sandy, so I have to wonder if Ed's side of the family didn't like her too much. Whatever the case, Blake was never considered a suspect, and while I can't positively confirm this, I did read a comment on the Unsolved Mysteries website that Blake was a drug addict, which might explain his behavior. During online searches, I also managed to find a photo of a grave for a Blake Edward Baker, who was buried in Gonzales, Texas after he died in 1995. I can't be 100% sure if this is the same guy, but the ages do match up. Anyway, I know that Sandy eventually moved to Europe, but it is interesting how she was not interviewed during the Unsolved Mysteries segment, even though Ed's ex-wife Mary was. Mary claimed that when Ed visited her shortly before his death, he said it was his idea to send Sandy to Austin for her own protection, which kind of goes against the idea of her traveling there to establish an alibi. As far as I can tell, it was after Ed sent Sandy away that he decided to go to the trouble of revising his will to ensure that she got the largest payout from his insurance policies. It was also Ed who contacted the insurance companies to check if his policies would still pay out in the event of a suicide, and he sent the letter to his attorney, Ward Boosey, asking him to watch over Sandy and his kids. The evidence does clearly show that Ed seemed to believe his days were numbered and wanted to ensure that his family was taken care of. Now, if you believe the fake death theory, this could come across as a similar scheme to the Clarence Roberts case, where Ed killed someone else and burned their body before going into hiding and waiting for Sandy to collect the insurance money. Afterwards, they would both take off to Europe together to live a life of luxury. However, like I stated earlier, I do think the dental records match is compelling enough to conclude that it was Ed Baker's body inside his burnt-out car. But let's just assume that the theory about Ed committing an elaborate suicide is correct. Even if Sandy was not directly involved, perhaps she still had advanced knowledge that Ed was planning to do this. It would definitely be interesting to see the contents of the final letter Ed wrote for Sandy, which he asked Ward Boosey to pass along to her. These letters are the main reason why Boosey was one of the biggest believers in the suicide theory. Boosey was interviewed on Unsolved Mysteries, and he says that the letter addressed to him stated, quote, "If you're reading this, I am dead." Since the letter was dated November the 6th, the day before Ed was killed, Boosey asked, how could Ed have known it would arrive after his death unless he was planning to take his own life? Well, the problem is that Boosey's quote during his interview is very misleading, and they actually do show the entire letter on screen during the Unsolved Mystery segment. Earlier in the episode, you heard me quote it word for word, and at no point did Ed actually write, "If you're reading this, I am dead." While Ed was obviously providing Boosey with instructions for how to handle things in the event of his death, he was not flat out predicting it would take place. All that being said, while Boosey's story about the letter might have been misleading, there is some logic to what he was saying. Ed did a number of things to suggest that he was preparing for his own death, though that could have been because he suspected he was going to be killed in the near future. While it doesn't seem suspicious that Ed would check on his life insurance policies and revise his will if he thought he was going to die, it is odd that he would specifically ask his insurance carriers if the policies would pay out in the event of a suicide. Why would you worry about something like that if you believed you were about to be murdered? If Ed's financial problems were so out of control that he knew there was no way he would ever dig himself out of that hole, he may have planned suicide as an escape, but to ensure his family would be taken care of financially, he also had to ensure that his death looked like a homicide. On the surface, it seems plausible that Ed could have been killed because he owed people money, but here's an important question. Besides Sandy and Mary, did Ed ever tell anyone else his life was in danger? Remember, he just suddenly showed up at Mary's house out of the blue one night to tell her what was going on, and then he wound up going missing several hours later. He told Mary that he had been receiving threatening letters at his workplace, but did anyone else actually see these letters or confirm that they existed? There really doesn't seem to be any logical reason for Ed to have visited Mary that night, unless he wanted to plant some seeds and give off the false impression he was about to be murdered. That way, when he wound up dead under suspicious circumstances a few days later, Mary would be able to corroborate his story about his life being threatened and make the police less likely to believe his death was a suicide. To be honest, for many years, I never found the suicide theory to be that plausible, but I reevaluated things a little bit when I read some articles published in the Houston Chronicle and other local newspapers following Ed's death, which contained some interesting pieces of information not mentioned on Unsolved Mysteries. Even though Ed's body was found on November the 8th, the segment never mentions how his gardener discovered he was missing on the morning of November the 7th, when he showed up at the Baker residence and found a broken window. While there were a few overturned items in Ed's bedroom, the place wasn't exactly ransacked, and quite frankly, it kind of gives me the impression that the whole scene might have been staged. Sure, it's possible that Baker could have been kidnapped by intruders who broke in and forced him to drive out to that remote rice field in his own Jaguar, but the detail that strikes me as particularly odd is how a shotgun he owned appeared to be the only item missing from the house. The Unsolved Mysteries segment mentioned the revolver being found on the floorboard of the burned-out Jaguar, but they did not mention that remains of what appeared to be a shotgun were also found inside the vehicle. So if Baker was abducted, why would they have taken his shotgun with him? Even though his body was badly burned, I think they were able to determine that he received a gunshot to the head at some point, and it likely came from the revolver, but regardless of whether this was murder or suicide, it still comes across as strange that two separate guns were found inside the car. There were apparently eyewitness accounts of smoke coming from the field during the early morning hours of November the 7th, which means that even though the vehicle was not discovered until the following day, it must have been burned only a few hours after Ed's final call with Sandy. So theoretically, after he finished the call, Ed could have overturned some items in the bedroom and broken his front window to create the false impression of a break-in before driving out into the field to take his own life. We do have the eyewitness sighting of an unidentified pickup truck which appeared to be speeding away from the field during the morning hours, which might suggest that someone else had been there and was involved in Baker's death. But for all we know, the truck could have just been passing through the area and has no connection to this case. However, even if this was a suicide, the person driving that truck still could have been involved with what happened, as one of the theories pushed forward by people who believe the suicide theory is that Baker could have had an accomplice who set fire to his vehicle after he shot himself. Indeed, the biggest issue with the suicide theory is that it really would not have been easy for Baker to kill himself in that fashion, especially if he was alone. The authorities found no less than 3 empty 1-gallon gas cans at the scene, but I have no idea if they were able to trace these gas cans and figure out if they might have been linked to Baker. Even though suicidal people can be capable of some pretty extraordinary things, it would still take an incredible amount of willpower to pour gasoline over your body, set yourself on fire, and then still have enough wherewithal to point a gun at your head and pull the trigger. I suppose an alternate explanation is that if Baker poured gasoline all over the car, he could have lit a match and thrown it into the back seat to ignite the fire, and then immediately shot himself before the flames managed to engulf his body. But still, Ed's entire motivation for ending his life in such a bizarre fashion was to eradicate all evidence that his death was a suicide and ensure his family could collect the life insurance, so how could he have been so certain that the fire would burn hot enough to destroy his body so thoroughly? What if the gun managed to stay in his hand after he shot himself? This is why I'm inclined to believe that Baker had at least one other person there to ensure the whole scheme went off as planned, and perhaps this person was the driver of the mysterious pickup truck. I have no idea who Baker could have enlisted to do this, but it would have been their responsibility to ensure that Baker's body and the vehicle were burned as thoroughly as possible, which technically could have made this an assisted suicide. As strange as this situation sounds, it's not unprecedented, as there are documented cases of people making their suicides look as unusual as possible to make everyone believe they were the victim of a homicide. As an example, look at the 2009 death of 51-year-old Bill Sparkman, who was found tied to a tree with a rope around his neck and died of an apparent asphyxiation. Sparkman was nude, gagged, and had a word written on his chest in a felt-tip marker, but as bizarre as the whole scene was, a thorough investigation revealed that his death was a suicide, as Sparkman was suffering from cancer and had staged his death to look like a homicide so his family could collect on some life insurance policies totaling $600,000. So who is to say that Ed Baker couldn't have attempted the same thing? And this leads us back to Sandy. Even if the story about Ed's life being in danger because he owed money to the mob was a complete fabrication, he was still facing a ton of trouble because of his financial indiscretions, and there was a very good chance he would go to prison. So Ed probably figured that no matter what, his life was ruined, and suicide was the only way out, but he still wanted to make sure his family was taken care of. If Ed told Sandy about this plan beforehand, then this would have motivated her to share her story about Ed's failure to pay back a loan to organized crime figures, planting the seeds that her husband was a victim of foul play, and this would allow her to collect on his life insurance policies. I may not put much stock into polygraphs, but this might explain why the results of Sandy's test seemed to indicate that she was withholding information. It wasn't because she had him murdered, but because she knew he had orchestrated an elaborate suicide plot. Like I mentioned earlier, when Ed visited Mary's house and told her that his life was in danger, this might have only been done for show. Look, I certainly do not rule out the possibility of foul play here, and if you asked me about this case a few years ago, I probably still would have said that Ed was murdered. But when you look at the big picture and examine all of Ed's actions prior to his death, everything seems pretty calculated. If this was a suicide, then I guess the only way to truly solve this case would be if someone else was complicit or had knowledge about what Ed was going to do. However, since many years have passed, I'm not sure if anyone is still actively working on this case anymore, so we'll probably never know the truth. But if you happen to have any information about the unexplained death of Ed Baker, please contact the appropriate authorities. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Now the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. We produced a bunch of exclusive bonus episodes for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3, and this past month, I released an episode about an unsolved mystery from the life of the most famous mystery writer of all time, Agatha Christie, who went missing in 1926 before she resurfaced 11 days later, and there are still a lot of unanswered questions about the circumstances of how and why she disappeared. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've also recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. So to learn more information, feel free to visit our Patreon page. I'd also like to give a shout out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Michael F., Margaret, Sana K., Donna B., and Javier A. Thank you so much for your support. I also just wanted to give another shout-out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online Forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to McGill Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. So have yourself a good week and join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. ¶¶